Well, this book has just been a pleasure to read and research all week long. The body has a mind of its own. It's all about body mapping, which you may have heard about in dribs and drabs your life. You know, no doubt heard about people who experience phantom limb syndrome. We talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Gary Schwartz, but this is really different. On every page, there are these, oh my God, kind of moments, or you know, even kind of I knew it moments. Like, these are things I've always thought were true, and now science is backing it up. And we'll talk about it with the two science writers who have been researching the subject of the brain maps of the body next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Sandra Blakeslee was it a third generation science writer?
That's right.
Okay, and then your son, Matthew Blakeslee, that makes you a fourth-generation science writer, the strong Blakeslee family tradition of science writing. And I understand, Sandra, you prefer to be called Sandy?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
And what was your pet name for Matthew growing up?
Mateo.
Mateo, okay.
Yep.
Okay, it wasn't like Wiggle Toes or Jiggly Pants or anything like that.
Gulagong was his fetal name.
Okay.
Never mind.
Bringing him back under,
right? All right, Matthew, I won't subject
don't
you
go,
to,
don't go there.
To being called what your mom called you your whole life growing up. My mom did that to me once at summer camp. She sent a note with my pet name on the front of the envelope, and they read it off at roll call, and I never lived that down for the rest of my life. The body has a mind of its own. This is great research. It's very entertainingly written, too. So thank you both, and I look forward to this conversation because you kind of eat. I mean, this isn't just, you know, a matter of I write this sentence and you write that sentence. You each have kind of your own specialties in the research on this?
Yeah, I think, well, we just flipped chapters back and forth. We said, you do one, I'll do two, you do three, you do four. And then we'd write them, and then we would just trade them off. So it was really
one of us would take the lead
effort.
Yeah, one of us would take a stab at the first draft of whichever chapter he or she felt most comfortable with the material with. But then we would just bat them back and forth, and through all those successive iterations, it would it evened out in writing style, and we got every point we wanted to make in.
Well, it's seamless, and it's very interesting. And I guess we should start a little bit at the beginning by talking about some of the things that people commonly would associate maybe with a body map, with a brain mapping of the own body, but may not have used that language before. So if you would, either Sandy or Matthew, will you talk about what is a body map and, like, you know, maybe use one of the rudimentary explanations that you have in the book?
I'll be happy to take that. Okay. So you know what a body is. That part is self-explanatory through common experience. And we should also define what a map is. So that a map is, you can think of a roadmap, for example, as the best example. It's any scheme or system that makes correspondences between two points and any different things. So on a roadmap, one point of ink on the page corresponds to some point in the real world, and adjacent points of ink on the map correspond to adjacent real-world locations. So your brain actually has literal maps of your body sort of quilted into its surface. And the two main maps, one of them is a map of all your skin receptors, of touch, somatic sensation, and the other one is of your body's musculature. So these are your two fundamental maps for sensation and movement.
Okay, and they're
literally are maps, so they have subsections. There's a part of your map for that corresponds to your thumb. There's another one that is for your neck, for your face.
And we're to understand that by thinking that the brain has sort of this map in it in built into the software of the brain, and that map tells the brain certain things that are involuntary and you know, reflex, or things that the brain just sort of takes care of itself by knowing where the lungs are and knowing how to make the fingers move or to raise a hand to keep you from being hit. But that the other part is the map of the brain, and maybe Sandy, you can pick this up. It shows an outline of where, sort of a mental picture of where the body ends and begins.
Right. So there's a really a sprawling network of maps. So the Matt just talked about the basic touch map, and there's a movement map. But if anybody's listening right now, if you just put your hand out in front of your body and wave it around up over your head and out to the left and to the right, all of that space out to the end of your fingertips is also mapped in your brain, literally mapped. All those points in space in an area called the parietal lobe, which is kind of over your ear. So when you're moving in that space or when anybody enters that space is mapped. And if you hold a tool like a rake or a cane or a fork or a knife or a computer, your body maps will expand to include the tool. So if you're driving a car, for example, or I was riding my bike today, and I was explaining this to someone, and so you're when you're riding a bike, your body map extends out to the front wheel and to the whole envelope of the bike. If you're in a car, your peripersonal space, it's called a peripersonal space map. That space map extends to include the roof of the car and the wheels and the fenders. So if you go into a parking garage and there's a barrier, you'll kind of want to duck because your space map is including the car.
Well, and I want to get back to that car piece here in just a second, but I think that's really interesting to think about even just the arm movement as you were talking about. If we're all just sitting right here and I was doing it while you spoke and I put my arms out to my side and I rotated my arms around in a couple of different directions, and by doing that, I'm still within my body space. My brain has mapped out all of this space. So if we were to look at it as a picture, we might see what somebody might describe as an aura around me. Let's say I've got, it's just sort of this globular kind of space around me.
Yeah, it's an envelope of space. It's attached to your skin.
Yeah, and it's attached to my skin. That's the interesting
thing. As far as your brain is concerned, yeah. That's one interesting thing is that your brain actually annexes this space into its model of yourself. It's not just that yourself ends at your skin. It's not an either or proposition for your brain.
And it's not just your brain. It's not just your brain imagines I can lay claim to this space. The brain sees that as my space, and that way, when somebody gets in, if somebody were standing too close to me, that's why we feel like they're in our space.
That's right.
Okay, it's not just, I don't like you being so close to me, you smell. It's like, you are standing within my brain space if someone's that close to me. Now, what happens when we all pack into an elevator? Does our body map shrink to accommodate all of the other body maps that are in the elevator?
You certainly feel the other mapping. You feel the other people. And so people tend to put their arms at their sides and they tend to look at the ceiling. You try to make yourself as small as possible.
And you do shrink. Yeah, you shrink into yourself. You will tolerate, bumps and much closer intrusions, if you want to call it that, if you have to.
Because the mind has told the body, retreat or shrink your space. And so we do it as a kind of reflex. We don't mentally decide, I must make my physical space smaller. It's just something we do because our mind tells us we can't take up that much space.
Right, and you're uncomfortable, so you'll definitely pull yourself in. But you also blend your space with others so that when you enter these, if you're close enough to a person to be in their space or they're in your space, you'll actually feel it. And my favorite example is really horseback riding. I've talked to a lot of equestrians and expert riders, and I'm pretty sure that the horse has a peripersonal space and the human has this peripersonal space. And an expert rider is really blended with the horse, whereas a novice rider is very clumsy and is not comfortable for a lot of motor reasons. But there's also a spatial reason that if you're, I don't know if you're a rider, but if you're comfortable with the animal, then you're just in sync with your spatial maps.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Then this goes back again to the idea of accommodating a car or a bicycle or a tool.
Right.
The body, the mind makes a decision that I'm going to get bigger now. My body literally is getting bigger by the attachment to something else. It's a symbiotic life form that essentially becomes one in our own brain.
Right, with a tool.
Yeah, there's some very interesting neuroscience behind this. In the book, we talk about some work that was done in Japan that kind of, took the lid off this and started to show how the nuts and bolts of it really work. And there are some amazing conclusions. Like, the work was done with monkeys, but it applies to us, too. In your parietal lobe, which Sandy was mentioning, you have all these higher-order representations of your body and the space around your body, and how your body sort of blends in with your surroundings. And if you're just empty-handed, you don't have any tools, the map representations of your arms and hands and fingers only extend out as far as you can naturally reach, just extending your unaided arm. But if you pick up something like a cane or a pointer or a rake was used in these Japanese experiments, your the visual part of that map actually extends out to the tip of that tool, of that rake or what have you. So it's a real literal expansion, and there's a real neural correlate to it. We're not just being fanciful, saying that we're incorporating tools when we use them. You are actually sensing stuff out to the tip of the tool, and your body is representing it as part of itself.
I found that part fascinating. If you took a rake and you hit it against the sidewalk, you feel the vibrations, and you feel that in your hand, but in your mind's map, the sensation at the tines of the rake, at the end of the rake, would be just the same as the ones that are at the end of your fingertips.
Correct. You probably aren't aware of the sensations in your hand at all. You're directly experiencing the texture and hardness of the ground through your cane or your rake.
Through the cane or the rake.
And it's this amazing transformation through your motor maps or your sensory maps.
We're talking about body maps with Sandy Blakeslee and her son Matthew Blakeslee, science writers, and body maps being the way in which your body knows where it begins and where it ends, and how fluid that is depending on what the mind needs from the body. And I think this is where it gets into a fascinating territory for me, as on this, we've heard about phantom limb syndrome, where somebody who has had an amputation still feels their toes, or can feel their toes tingle, or they can't scratch an itch that exists on a leg which is not there anymore, and how mad that can drive them. And yet what the research has been showing is that this is very, it's almost as though the mind has kept the original blueprint for the body. Would that be a fair analogy? It's like the body has found a way to keep the original leg design or the nerve patterns for the legs, and to keep it in its own locked in a way.
It's a little different.
Go ahead.
So let's say you lose an arm, like your left arm is amputated, or
right.
Lost in Iraq, lost in an automobile accident, farm accident, whatever. So there's a faithful map of your entire left arm in the right side of your brain. There's a whole little area of tissue in the right side of your touch map, which represents that arm. Suddenly it's gone. Suddenly it's gone. So the tissue that's adjacent to the arm map is now sort of, the question when this was worked out about 10 years ago is, well, what happens? Does it just die? Is it empty? Is it vacant? Is there just a hole in your map? No, because the brain is very what they call plastic. It abhors a vacuum. So what happens is that the map areas adjacent to, right next to the arm map, there are connections that are unmasked, or there's actually sprouting of connective of connections, like a little dendrites and things, will expand, and they will move into the area where the arm map was. So in the case of the arm, what's mapped right next to the arm is the face and the trunk? I forget. Anyway, if it's the face, let's say you're a guy, and if you're shaving the left side of your face, that activation on your left cheek is going to activate your arm map, which is no longer there, and you're going to feel a phantom.
That was what I was talking about when I was talking about saving the blueprint. It's almost like it kept it in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah, there are two parts of the answer. One is your arm is gone, but your brain still has a map for that arm. It still has a representation of it. So any sort of stray or ambient activity in that arm map, you are going to experience. And, you know, this is your brain's model of your arm. And so you continue to experience the arm.
Right, and the arm map can get activated even though there's no arm anymore by adjacent tissue, like the skin on your cheek will activate the missing arm map.
Yeah, so in some people, the arm map will just slowly disappear. It'll fade, and like Sandy's saying, adjacent areas of your map, such as from your cheek and your upper arm, will kind of invade, take over the old area, and you no longer experience a phantom. In other people, the phantom will stick around for a long time, and that representation of the arm just doesn't go away.
Yeah, I think that was the most fascinating thing, too, Sandy, was what you're talking about there. I want to tease out a little bit more, that for people who are experiencing that, they could find the specific part of their face, that when they touched that part of their face, they experienced the touching of their face and the touching of the missing arm simultaneously.
Right. So you can actually map the entire phantom on the face. Ramachandran did this work, a guy at UCSD, and I wrote a book with him a few years ago, and actually Matt worked with him at UCSD as an undergrad. So what Rama did was he mapped out the missing phantom on the first person. He had used a Q-tip, and he would run the Q-tip down the guy's face and on his chest, and he was able to map the missing arm by touching him on these adjacent parts of his body, which means those adjacent maps were invading the arm map, which was no longer extant. I mean, it was the tissue is still there, but it's not getting feedback from the actual arm because the arm is missing. So it's by stimulating the adjacent tissue, you get sensation on the missing arm, and that's what the phantom is. So the phantom is actually real. I mean, the phantom is, you get this impression that you have an arm or a leg when they're gone, but you really are getting activity in the brain, and so your brain has got the arm in there it's an adjacent activation.
Right. But then this is the part. This is the kicker. Is if that missing limb is retransplanted, if something comes back onto that arm, that extends into what the old body map was, the mind readjusts, and suddenly you can't feel your arm on your face.
That's right.
It's as though they pulled the old blueprint out of the drawer and put it back on the table again.
They did this with a hand transplant in France, where the guy had lost his hand, and then they transplanted another hand back, and so his maps, he had a phantom, and then he had a real hand again.
Yeah, that's amazing. he had a phantom, and they could find where the phantom was on his body. They could see where the phantom nerves were being stored, or the phantom receptors were being stored, and then when they put his hand back on it, it disappeared from that other space.
Right.
Okay, that tripped me out when I read that. I thought that's just amazing. All right, well, and this is just kind of getting into it, too, because there's a lot of different ways we can go from here, but that's a great introduction to what a body map means in a very practical way of understanding it. Here's how I kept picturing it, is our body maps look like the images that we generate when we are captured on film or on video in a heat generating video. We're using a lens that detects heat movement, right?
Yeah. But more than just that space map, you know, there's that real physical map of all your limbs and your teeth and your tongue and your, you know, your face, your toes, your fingers. All of those are faithfully mapped. But there's also maps of your joints and your musculature, which gives you a sense of where you are in space. There's a map of your emotions, sort of, that come off of your skin and off of your nervous system. If your heart's beating a little faster, or if you're sweating slightly or flushing, there's a very accurate map of that feeling from your body, especially from your heart and your lungs and your other innards, your guts. And that's mapped up to give you a sense of your social emotions.
All right, well, hang on to that thought, and we'll get back to more, too, on how body maps inform other conversations we've been having on Coast to Coast AM next. Well, we were talking about body maps and how the brain incorporates a cane into the body map of a, say, a blind person going down the street, using a cane, tapping ahead of them, that the end of that cane actually becomes the hand. That it isn't the hand feels the cane, that the hand feels the hardness of the cane, but it's the nerve sensations at the end of the cane that becomes the hand. I'm losing my voice. Excuse me. But what else can a body map do? We'll let Sandy Blakeslee and Matthew Blakeslee tell you the story of the blind painter and the amazing accomplishment of the mind there next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Sandy Blakeslee was talking, and I just had got to the bottom of the hour. So did you want to finish that thought in any way before we move on?
Oh, no, we're okay. We'll just keep going.
Okay. Sandy Blakeslee and Matthew Blakeslee, co-authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own. Let's talk about this body mapping idea in context of that story you tell about the blind painter, because that's really trippy.
Very cool. I know. So this guy's name is Esraf Armagan, and he's a Turkish painter. He's been blind since birth in both eyes. He was imaged recently, or his brain was imaged in a lab by a guy named Alvaro Pascal Leon at Harvard. And so he was given these objects to feel. I think he had a coffee cup and a toothbrush, stuff like that. And then he was asked to draw them on paper. Now, he, of course, can't see, but he can draw really beautifully. He can draw, you know, objects, and he can draw people, he can draw scenes. So you wonder how he can do that. And it has to do with what's called plasticity. So this guy is born without a visual input coming to his brain. So he has no visual maps. And if you put your hand on the back of your head, your visual cortex is back there, and that's where all the tissue is that you use for seeing. That's where your visual maps are. So he had no vision there. So the adjacent maps for touch and for various senses, hearing and so on, the rest of his body, invaded that tissue that would normally do vision, so that when he was asked to paint or to feel something and then paint it, he could do it via touch. So his visual cortex wasn't empty. It was just filled in by all these other senses, and that's how he was able to paint. When people read Braille, they're able to read the letters through their fingers. They don't have, you know, visual cortex, but they can read perfectly well. But you can, with a magnet, you can knock out their ability to read by knocking out the visual cortex, which is where the touch map is coming in.
Totally. But I think it was about the painter that even tripped me out a little bit more was how he was able to do these things in very sort of complex dimensional representations, and it reminded me of the movie, the not very successful comic book movie that I liked but nobody else did, called Daredevil, which was based in the comic book series about this guy who is blind but has, especially now that I understand the body mapping idea, essentially uses his body map and the body maps of other people around him, and he's able to visualize things just through that interaction.
Right, there's Japanese movies too, The Blind Swordsman, the wonderful films about people that can be these martial arts artists, you know, with swords, and they're just using their very personal space and hearing and touch in order to move through the world very accurately.
Yeah.
So it makes you appreciate how your physical intelligence, your bodily awareness is really fundamental to your ability to move around in the world.
Yeah, I
your
totally
other senses
agree.
Like hearing and sight, they're very prominent in your awareness. They have, you know, they're very fancy senses. They have lots of bells and whistles, and you know, we love them all. But sort of more self-effacing, but far more important than any one of them or all of them put together, the others put together, is your body sense, and that emerges through this network of body maps that you have. That's the core of your sensory being.
Well, and you reference a particular website in the book, and what I did is I put that on my blog. So if anybody goes to coasttocoastam.com, you hit the link to my blog, and it'll take you to the link. It would be too hard to like tell you what the long address over the air. The URL is kind of complicated, a lot of backslashes and stuff. But if you go to my blog at coasttocoastam.com, and you can go from there, it'll take you to that really cool sensory little experiment where you look on the computer and then you close your eyes and you hear the same thing without looking at it. And I thought that was pretty instructive for what we're talking about. But I'll go back to some other things, because the mind then also can sort of play tricks on the body. And I want to talk about this a little bit. Because I think it informs some conversations we've been having on Coast to Coast. So plasticity, in a way, can kind of go wrong, too, can't it? I mean, there are times when it can start to work against you. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. You want to go, Matt? You want to try that?
Matt or Sandy?
Can you handle this one?
Oh, sure. Okay, so you have these very faithful maps for, let's say, playing golf or tennis or basketball or any, let's take a sport. You have very finely honed motor maps, or playing even better, a musical instrument. Let's say you're a violinist or a guitarist, especially a stringed instrument. Your fingers are just flying over the frets and on the strings, and your finger maps, actually for musicians that play string instruments, their finger maps are larger than yours or mine. They have them, they're kind of beefed up from playing.
So the more they play an instrument, the larger their fingers grow in the map of the mind.
Right. The representation in the brain is larger for the finger. And when you're learning to play an instrument, those maps grow in size. As you become a master of an instrument, the primary map gets a little smaller, but there's a whole nest of motor maps. So the motor skill gets moved up a hierarchy eventually, but that's sort of a detail. But when you are learning an instrument, or let's say to take an instrument, your finger maps will get bigger in your brain, in the motor area. But what can happen is that if you learn something so well, the map can blur. So you're able to move your fingers, but in your brain, let's just hold your two fingers out, your middle finger and your index finger, those maps can become fused in your brain, because they're just sort of overused, and this happens with a musician's cramp. So a violinist or a guitarist will suddenly, their hands get kind of ham-fisted. They can't move their fingers over the strings as well, and they kind of it can actually ruin careers. Or piano players have the same problem. And what's happened is that the individual finger maps usually have a map for each finger. They fuse in the brain. Now, you look at your hand, you still have five separate fingers, but the map in the brain is fused. So you can't play anymore. There is a technique, though. A guy in Europe developed a technique for splinting the fingers and doing exercises and then driving the map apart again.
In the brain.
Able to cure musician's cramp.
That's right, yeah, the hand map, it's sort of become like a mitten. The representations of all the fingers have blurred together. But through an understanding of how plasticity in the brain works and how the hand map comes to be in the first place, this technique actually re-separates the finger maps and allows the musicians to play again. Very cool stuff.
It is. And yet, too, and this maybe this is a good or a bad transition, I don't know, but it does go back to another conversation we've been having on Coast to Coast about out-of-body experiences.
Right.
And I will tell you that and I've referenced it several times, I used to have them all the time.
Yeah.
Until I was in my late teens, I used to have these OBEs where I would be, just as you described in the book, I would be in an instant, I would suddenly be feeling myself float up to an area of, or I felt like I was sitting on my own shoulders, looking down on myself while other things were happening. And I could kind of hear what was being said, but I was more in a place where I was observing, very much felt visually observing things that were happening from a perspective I couldn't have at my height, but I could have it when I was suddenly projected out of my body. And this happened to me all the time. And yet you've got an explanation.
This happens to people all the time. They're not at all uncommon. And this has to do with your body maps. And they can easily fall out of sync. Some people more than others. But there's a guy in Switzerland who has induced out-of-body experiences two ways. One, with epilepsy surgery, they have to go in and put a probe in the brain and try to find out where the abnormal tissue is. So this guy was probing a woman's brain, and he hit an area called the angular gyrus. And it's where these body maps come together, where your body is represented in space. It's kind of a spatial map. And suddenly, he hit it with the electrode, and then boom, she's on the ceiling, looking down, her feet are dangling. And then when he turned the electrode off, she was back in her body. Turns it on, she's on the ceiling. Turns it off, she's back in her body. That was the first time anybody had, induced one in a patient. But just recently, in August, two groups, one in England and one in Switzerland, induced out-of-body experiences in normal, healthy individuals like you and me. And they used virtual reality goggles to do this. I don't know if you, did you read those stories? Did you see those?
Yeah, I have. So talk about this, because I think this is the part where a lot of people like me who felt the reality of that out-of-body experience are being challenged to think maybe this is just a physical phenomenon that has nothing to do with the separation between the soul and our, I say the soul for lack of any other way to describe it, and our physical body.
Well, so let's just back up. These experiences happen all the time to people all over the world. They've been happening forever, out-of-body experiences. But if there's no scientific explanation, if scientists come and tell you, no, you're just imagining it, or, we can't explain it, then you have to look for some explanation, because they're real. These phenomena
happen. Experiences are certainly real.
All the time. So now what the neuroscience of this kind of mapping phenomenon are showing, that you can induce it in an otherwise normal, healthy person. And we're all healthy. People have out-of-body experiences. They're healthy. This group in England and in the other group in Switzerland, they put a virtual reality goggles on the person, and then you look out on the goggles and you see yourself. You see yourself about 6 feet in front of you. You see your back projected in front of you. And then they take a stick or a pen or something like that, and they'll stroke the avatar of you out there in front of you in the goggles. At the same time, they stroke your back with the same rhythm. And this causes a confusion in your mind. It confuses your body maps. It confuses your touch and your vision, because your vision sees you 6 feet in front of you, but touch is telling you that you're being touched, and so is the avatar being touched, and boom, you move out of your body into the avatar.
Now, they ought to have that available at, like, stores. People ought to be able to do that for $50, be able to go into a booth, and I'm really serious, and
sure,
be able to experience, I hope it is, where you can really see you can really experience that out-of-body sensation just by inducing it using, these goggles and a stick.
The thing about that particular set of experiments is that it's a very kind of poor out-of-body experience. You don't have the sense of hearing and seeing and feeling or rotating. What many people talk about is they're actually floating over their bodies. They feel a sense of flying. They can, it's a very rich experience for many people. And that's because in this particular experiment, they're only manipulating touch and vision. But if you went in and if you were manipulating what they call vestibular cortex, which is your sense of balance, and proprioceptive cortex, which is where your sense of your body sense of where you're located in space. And if you were tweaking all of those maps at once, then you would be flying out of your body, and you would have that richer, full-blown out-of-body experience. When they happen, the near-death experiences happen similarly. And one of the explanations, which you can believe that there's a soul and you're detaching from your body from a soul. but you can also explain it, or some of, not all maybe, but some, by a lack of oxygen, a sort of a hypoxic blow to this right angular gyrus region of the brain where your sense of body and space is located. And there's some large blood vessels right there. So if you're, let's say you have a heart attack or you're in a car accident, you're going to get a lack of blood flow to that region, and that region's going to get knocked offline. And that could induce a major out-of-body experience.
A kind of near-death experience, though, which, and this is where it's sort of challenging, because I don't know why I was able to see the things I saw when I was going through my out-of-body experiences as a kid.
After your teenage years, you said?
Well, they went away after my teenage years, yeah, but I remember being able to see things. I mean, actually physically see something that I could not have seen. And that kind of backs up some research that's been done on these near-death experiences where people have come back from a near-death experience with knowledge and or making observations that it seems like that it would have been impossible for them to have done.
Right. I've heard those stories, and I don't think we, you know, science, the kind of reductionist science that we're talking about, can't answer that at this
okay.
point.
But it really can get, and it can go down the road part way anyway.
Right, just part way. And it can part way to the physiology of how you would leave your body. But I don't think, you know, you'd have to kind of run experiments too. And maybe they can do that. And eventually with the virtual reality, you could start testing people's ability to see things. Those are all self-reports, and they're pretty strange, and I don't think the kind of science we're talking about can answer all of that at this point.
There's been some interesting scientific research on that, though, too. So I'm sort of curious now to see how this might inform or challenge some of those other programs that have been run in the past on that. I will say this, though, quite obviously, whereas I think it's a good idea that they have these stores that might induce an out-of-body experience, perhaps a franchise that induces near-death experiences would be a difficult business model.
It would be a little too much.
That probably wouldn't be something that would work. But it is compelling, because this would explain a little bit more about why these sort of things happen. Now, Matthew, was there anything about the fact that these went away when I was a teenager? Does that tell you anything? Does that speak to body mapping at all, or how the brain works?
Well, at a general level, I mean, I had synesthesia when I was young, and that's a mingling of the senses. There are lots of ways for the senses to mingle in synesthetes. Mine was, it involved textures and flavors. That might sound random to some people who've never heard of synesthesia, but certain textures I would feel with my hand would just lead to these bizarre flavors that have no analog in real foods I've ever tasted, that would pop into my mouth as long as I was feeling those things. And this went away after adolescence. You know, the brain is still developing and reorganizing until the end of, until even into the early 20s. So things like this can persist and then go away. And there are individual differences that are still very unclear as to why some people will have experiences like you had or like I had. But it's a fascinating set of questions.
It is.
Synesthesia, too, because we talk about auras in the book, too, and there's a guy in London who studies colored auras, patients that see colored auras, and they're born that way, and they see colored auras around, you know, Charlie's got a blue halo around him.
Well, actually, I want you to hang on to that, Sandy, because we're coming to the end of the hour.
Okay.
I want you to hang on that, because I think that discussion about auras is also something we've talked about a lot on Coast to Coast, and whether or not the answer that you see in the body has a mind of its own answers all of those things about auras, it certainly, I think, is a conversation worth having. We'll do that coming up. Also, I want you to talk about the ways in which we need to reconfigure our own body maps, how we can reboot our body maps, and why we need to reboot them, essentially, from time to time, why it would be beneficial to us to be able to be aware of the fact that we have a body map, and then how to control it, how to manipulate it so that our body works at a peak efficiency. And then we'll get to questions early, I believe, coming up for Sandra Blakeslee and Matthew Blakeslee, co-authors of The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, how body maps in your brain help you do almost everything better on Coast to Coast AM.